Just going back a little bit to another book, to the, your 1985 book, Theoretical Epidemiology: Principles of Occurrence Research in Medicine, what influence do you think it had? And, well, just that for the beginning.
It was not designed to be a textbook in teaching. I never myself, in my extensive international teachings, had that as a textbook. Never. So it was sort of an expression of thoughts of the moment, heavy on statistics, for instance, over heavy by far for an introductory text. And so I did not intend it to be used in teaching. I never did that, as I just said. And I don't think that it has had any major impact. But as I said a moment ago, I think these current developments, first of all, they are directed to teaching, and they are directed to introductory teaching. And if they don't have an impact, I will have been a failure. And that's what they will be saying posthumously, that Miettinen made an attempt, you know, around 2010, 12.
I'm struck by the what you said to me recently about the book you're planning on epidemiologic research, An Introduction. You mentioned to me in speaking that the material in this introductory book you're planning could also serve well outside of epidemiology. For example, in areas of research in criminology and psychology, even in other fields. And you seem to imply that the thinking in epidemiologic research was more advanced and more sophisticated than it's in many other fields. Do you want to elaborate a little bit on that? Did
Well,
I hear you right?
yes, quite accurate. Let's take it that insofar as epidemiological research is research into the frequency of occurrence of a phenomenon, as this frequency depends on its determinants in a defined domain. If this is what is meant by epidemiological research, surely that phenomenon need not be a health phenomenon in a health domain. Surely it can be a matter of accidents occurring in highways. It can be a matter of misspellings in textbooks. The occurrence frequency concept, of course, covers a whole lot of any territory, whatever that you care to think about. Now, I am not justified, other than intuitively, saying that we in this health research business that we think of as epidemiological research, that we probably have had a stronger motive and a more serious effort to understand this research than people in linguistics, for example. But I don't know this. I'm just guessing it.
Okay.
And I'm rather comfortable with that presumption, but I don't have justification. And so I'm just to agree that a student whose field is psychology, for instance, or criminology, or whatever, that they would do very well, in my opinion, coming to an epidemiology program and learning the ropes about the research in this way, and then going and doing their work in their particular field.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, other epidemiologists who have been interviewed for the series, for far other epidemiologists who have been interviewed in the series, the focus has been on what makes for good epidemiologic research and good collaboration and collaborators. But I take it, and it's clear from what we've been saying, that you consider yourself first and foremost a developer and a teacher in the broadest sense of theoretical epidemiology. And so your readers will be interested in what you think makes a good teacher and your own assessment then of how well you've succeeded on this.
Yeah, I am a bit frustrated with the academic culture today where, when it comes to teaching, the mantra seems to be effectiveness of teaching, as though at issue were simply how well do you transmit your own understanding to your students. If I imagine myself again as a student in the early 60s, whom would I have liked to have as my teachers? Surely Nathan Mantel, for example, mm-hmm. who by the prevailing criteria was an awful teacher. But by my criteria, he would have been a deluxe teacher. R.A. Fisher, another statistician, mm-hmm. you know, would not cut it by today's criteria. But gee whiz, what a privilege it would have been to be a student of R.A. Fisher. Mm-hmm. I'm saying that to me, the key regarding a teacher is for them to master their stuff. They may stutter and they may digress and whatever, but when you have a question, do you get the ultimate answer from this teacher? That to me is the touchstone. And in this way, I have endeavored over the years to really learn the stuff for myself. And then I don't pay a whole lot of attention to effectiveness of transmission, although I have a good deal of experience with that and have come to various ideas as to how to actually bring the student to the threshold of their own understanding. But again, key by far is mastery of your stuff rather than your technology of teaching.
Okay. Before we go on to the next main heading that the journal asked us to consider, I'd just like your views on a collection of different topics. Some of these you may want to say it's covered in one of the two books recently or so on, or you may want to expand here. So in no particular order, these are, I've one under the heading of odds ratios and logistic regression. Let me explain. If I understand you correctly, at one level, you think the 2x2 table and the odds ratio should be demoted or maybe even proscribed. And at another level, you are saying logistic regression should be promoted to be the single central regression method for all of etiologic, diagnostic, and prognostic research. Is that an accurate depiction of your views, and do you see any contradiction in what I'm saying?
Well, accurate it is, and no contradiction whatsoever. Mm. Let me say, when I was starting half a century ago, the 2x2 table was everywhere. And it was a disastrous misguidedness of teaching, where you sample from one margin and you have cohort study, and you sample from another margin and you have case control study, and you sample from the corner and you have cross-sectional study. Awful stuff. And here developed the preoccupation with odds. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, logistic regression, of course, has on the left-hand side the logarithm of odds regarding the outcome event. The theory of logistic regression, of course, is impeccable as statistical theory. It hit epidemiology, by the way, in 1967.
62, with Cornfield.
What?
1962, with Cornfield.
I thought it was 67.
Formally in 67, yeah.
From Framingham.
Yeah, but he...
But it was based on discriminant function.
Yeah.
And the maximum likelihood approach came simultaneously. 67, in my mind.
Yeah, okay.
And so there it came with considerable force, and it was a welcome development. But the curious thing is that the case control study topic, once again, if you have a case series and a base series, now the odds, so to speak, is about caseness versus baseness. Mm-hmm. It is not caseness versus non-caseness. It is caseness versus baseness. Mm-hmm. And the logistic model applies to this probability ratio. After all you have in the left-hand side, on the left-hand side is probability ratio. Mm-hmm. One is the complement of the other, mm-hmm. but it need not be.
That's right.
So probability of caseness for a person moment versus probability of baseness for a person moment. Mm-hmm. And now you formulate that logistically, fine. There is no odds here whatsoever. If you have two incidence density formulations, numerator entry, denominator, numerator entry, denominator, there is no number of non-cases. There is just the cases and the base size, cases and the base size. And this is what the logistic is about in your etiologic study, and hence no conflict. And we should grow out of this business of reporting odds ratios from etiologic studies. Readers have no meaningful concept to go with that. They ought to learn to say rate ratio.
Yeah.
Rate ratio. That's all it is.
The next one is Bayesian analysis or Bayesian methods and their place, if any, in epidemiologic research. Your succinct views on that.
Bayesian statistics was brought to North America by Savage, having spent his sabbatical with Definetti in Italy. And what I saw Savage bringing more than anything else was the concept of subjective probability rather than so much method. My first class in biostatistics, professor tosses a coin, successfully catches it, looks at the class, asks, what's the probability of heads? And we all thought 0.5. Wrong. Either it is heads or it is not. There is no probability. The idea that probability in statistics has only to do with relative frequency was very ingrained in statistics, even when in science, probability is a matter of degree or belief. What about the Big Bang theory? Is it correct? You say probably. Mm-hmm. You are expressing belief. Mm-hmm. That's all over the place in science. In statistics, it's a late idea. But that said, it seems to me that from the methods point of view, from a statistical process point of view, that one should not really say that there is frequentist analysis and there's Bayesian analysis. There is statistical evidence in both camps in the form of likelihood function, as far as I'm concerned. And the duality emerges only in so-called inference, rather than in the methods. So there has been, in my view, in recent years, excessive preoccupation in epidemiology with Bayesian methods. I am not really interested in that topic.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Corrections for multiple testing.
Another misunderstanding. In statistics, you have the topic of analysis in analysis of variance, where you actually have a nominal scale determinant and you have observations in each of the categories. And now you have the omnibus null hypothesis of no difference, any difference among these categories. And now you have component contrasts and you get different results from the significance testing point of view. And now, therefore, the inconsistencies among the different tests strikes a student of statistics in their statistics studies. Now, the idea that in science we are dealing with this topic when we, in an etiologic study, have several etiologic hypotheses being tested, for example. We don't ever entertain the omnibus null hypothesis. These hypotheses are generally wholly independent of one and other. And the question of how many hypotheses have you tested lately is no proper question to a scientist. If it were a proper question, then how many hypotheses do you plan to test? How many hypotheses have your colleagues tested? This is utter nonsense. And then the Bonferroni correction and so on. You know, statistics ought to stay in its omnibus hypothesis topic and not presume to extend that to science. It's a misunderstanding, mm-hmm. profound, serious misunderstanding, rather like sample size determination, which yes. is one of the awful imports from statistics to science.
Which I saw the other day, the absence of it was considered unethical in a recent report that you and I know well.
Yeah,
really.
And it yeah. is absolutely yeah. mindless yeah, stuff.
Yeah. Causal inference is another fad these days.
It is. And if I may be critical about it, I say that there seems to be this dream of a method for moving from evidence to causal understanding inference. You know very well that in a logic there is deductive logic and there's inductive logic. But inductive logic really is almost a contradiction in terms. There is a limited domain for such things, but the movement from evidence to inference on an abstract level, there can never, I suggest for your consideration, be a theoretical methodology for this. It will remain, an intuitive realm where no one can come with authority that I have calculated the truth here. Mm-hmm. No, that's a false dream in my view.
Mm-hmm. And the other peer review itself and the whole process. Again, I see from your from your reaction.
Look, it's one of those things that it's like democracy.
Okay.
That we suffer democracy and we suffer peer review well aware about the pain in it. And in particular, I have this view, and by the way, when I peer review, I never say to the editor, don't publish. I present my critique, and I present that not only to the editor, but to the authors as well. And you go and make whatever you care to make of this. So again, there should not be censorship. Mm-hmm. And in particular then, if somebody has something extraordinary to say, it is quickly weeded out from the literature by peer review, which is really stuck with the prevailing paradigms and does not tolerate deviations from it. Related to this issue of decisions about publication, I have said it in my 85 textbook already, that decisions about publication should be taken without the results being at hand. As you well know, today publication acceptance is highly dependent on what your results are, rather than how worthy your topic was and how well designed your study was. And this is a built-in bias. But yeah, I have no improvement for the peer reviewing itself other than I wish others would do what I do. Present your thoughts, but don't block publications.
Okay, so that was a set of topics that the journal hadn't asked about, but now we move back to ones they have. And they've asked, although I don't think it applies particularly to you, on how you choose the research topics you want to address. Do you still want to answer
what
that?
What I can there say is that I do have ideas as to how people should choose them. Okay. Even if I am not in the process of choosing.
Right.
And there, the beginning of all wisdom, in my view, in epidemiological research is that it should not be driven by investigator interest. Cut out all talk about investigator interest. Society pays for the research, and it does not pay for the researcher to indulge in their hobby. No, the society wishes to have worthy results from your work toward public health, and therefore one should be concerned with what is worth studying from the societal point of view and at the same time feasible to meaningfully study. And so again, it is a matter of object design in these terms. Now, when I was a PhD student, I for a while entertained the idea of writing a thesis in epidemiological research. And I was already then thinking this way. What is it that people really would like to learn about from epidemiological research? And whereas common ideas at the time, like today, are all prevention of cardiovascular disease, prevention of cancer, I thought that people probably would appreciate the focus on the upstream topic of rate of aging. If only people would know what in their diet serves to slow down aging, biological aging, they really would take note of that and they would probably act accordingly, the other gender in particular, but all of us. And therefore, research on rate of aging, really, I felt then and I feel today, is an example of well-chosen topic. Question is, though, do you know how to do that? And notably, do you have a way of measuring people's rate of aging?
Individuals.
Yeah. How do you classify somebody as being a slow ager, somebody else as a fast ager? You have to be able to do that. Otherwise, you can't do the work. And so I thought about that, and I thought I had the solution as to how you can develop an index of rate of aging. I, in fact, published that later in some other context. And so I thought that it was feasible and worthwhile. And be that as it may, people may or may not agree with me, but my point still is that one should not be driven by one's interests, nor by opportunities, but by a sense of purpose, that the work is there in the service of public health and it is feasible to validly, meaningfully conduct. Mm-hmm. So notice I'm opinionated even if I'm not involved.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm curious how what idea you had and how it might be, the rate of aging might be measured. It's not telomere length or anything like that, is it?
That's probably too sophisticated.
Yeah.
But there are a number of physiognomic features that show aging. The one that even has the term to that is presbyopia. Presbyopia refers to old, aged.
Okay.
And so how was it in high school? Did you have glasses then? And then what is your current, just an example. Mm-hmm. What was your height at that time? What is it now?
Mm-hmm.
Measures of skin
skin. Simple things then.
All sorts of things are there, including, by the way, arguably, your facial appearance.
Of course.
Now, you have all sorts of indices, but that's not the point. That's the beginning. Now, the added thing is that you have somebody's chronological age.
Mm-hmm.
So now, first phase is let's estimate chronological age on the basis of these things.
Yes.
And now for an individual, you have their estimated chronological age and their actual chronological age. And their ratio speaks to the rate of aging.
Mm-hmm.
So the beginning is estimation of chronological age. And if you can do that, then you have a rate of
I'm going to share with you later a study on twins from Denmark that was published a couple of Christmases ago on exactly that. And people are very good at working out the difference between chronological.
Oh, you mean just the impression?
Just from photographs.
Yeah.
There's some beautiful work from Denmark, I think it is, on this. Yeah, and it was impressive.
Yeah.
So now turning now to matters outside of epidemiology, what have you been your major interests outside of epidemiologic activities? I know sports one, but more intellectual things, I guess.
I have sort of led on that parallel with epidemiology or epidemiological research, I have always had a keen interest in clinical research. And so the meta-epidemiological clinical research topic has been an explicit professional preoccupation.
Right.
But apart from that, all along, considerable interest in matters intellectual, whether in science or in technology, and in humanities as well. And even in our monotheistic and other religions, because the evolution of ideas over time in its respective categories is a theme that really interests me. And I would, of course, hope that in epidemiology we would have a faster rate of evolution of ideas than we have had, and in clinical research, just the same. We are excessively conservative in that way. So themes like this, and then, of course, reading extensively, including most recently, for instance, David Deutsch has this wonderful book, The Beginning of Infinity. He is a polymath physicist. He's an engineer in quantum computing and is preoccupied with what it is that makes for human progress or progress in human societies. And he is a great aficionado of Bronowski, that you know, the ultimate polymath, mathematician, playwright, inventor, book author, the author of this wonderful book, The Ascent of Man. And recently, most recently, just a week ago, I read through Neil Ferguson's book, Civilization, The West and the Rest. And the big theme there is, what is it that has made for the ascendancy of the West over the last half millennium? And there are six pillars there, and medicine is one of them. And so I was particularly interested in how he sees the role of medicine in the ascendancy of the West or Western civilization. But that gives you a sense of what the preoccupations are lateral to epidemiology.
Yeah. The one other one that you didn't mention, and it's lower down probably in level, is Malcolm Gladwell. Where you mentioned in
I have read his books.
But what impresses me about him is how normal his English is. You know, the words don't get in the way at all. He's like a guy you meet in the bus that you talk to. His style of writing is very
earthy
and accessible and so on. And I'm wondering.
But his writing is not really on scholarship.
Absolutely not.
He is writing for the lay audience.
Yeah, yeah.
And the thing is that he makes these observations.
Yeah. So you think for those other types, the Neil Fergusons and the others, they need to have
scholar,
and they have to write at a higher level.
Mm.
Okay.
Now Bronowski arguably wrote for the general audience, as you know, it was a television series and so on.
First, yeah, yeah.
So he and so he's sort of intermediate there.
Yeah.
It seems to me.
Now, in your opinion, what's been epidemiology's most important contribution to society?
there's no question, ascendancy over communicable disease. Mm-hmm. Communicable disease control. This is what Ferguson actually only, this is the only feature of medicine that he brings up.
Yeah.
The
and of course it's in the word epidemiology that we have as well, right?
But he does not use the word epidemiology.
Does he not? Yeah.
Nor do epidemiologists today, when they define epidemiology, they don't think of practice of epidemiology.
But I'm thinking of the epidemics and the
community. To be sure. Yeah, yeah, yeah. To me, it is amazing that we don't have today the concept of practice of epidemiology. In my introductory book upcoming that I'm working now on, I deal with, among other things, with the public health office of the city of Ottawa and how evident it is from their work and their language and their reports that they are practicing epidemiology for the population of the city of Ottawa. But we academics, we have lost sight of practice of this community medicine, which is really amazing. You have noticed perhaps that a very small hole is somewhat difficult to discern, but if a hole is enormous, it's also difficult to see.
Yes.
And we have some enormous holes in our perception of issues before us in epidemiology. Prime among them is failure to think about practice of community medicine.
Now, your assessment, what would it be of the current state of health of epidemiology then? What are the biggest risks and opportunities? But
again, if epidemiology means practice of epidemiology, then you have one answer. If it is research, it's another answer. Now, I have no problem with today's practices of epidemiology other than what I mentioned earlier in this discussion.
Our liberties.
That we have really gone too close to the Nazi society, where society dictates how the individual conducts themselves in respect to health issues. But as for the research, public is ultimately what we are supposed to be in the service of. And we supposedly then conduct research so that the public ever better knows how to preserve their health and how to promote their health and whatever they care to think about in respect to preventive medicine, which is what epidemiology really is about in the community sense. Now, people read mostly about nutrition, which is the first order concern. And they are very, very bewildered by the conflicting, changing ideas that come from epidemiology. And further, some of the topics get to be almost sort of laughter-provoking. And so we really ought to tidy up this whole operation of epidemiological research, notably as for what comes to public attention. One of the remedies, in my view, would be that there should be no press release, not from a university nor from a journal, of a current paper published. Only reviews deserve public attention. And that would help us a great deal. But we, for some reason, have two big egos there in universities and in journals, so that they tout their most recent.
Our own university has a press office for exactly that purpose.
Yeah, it is just unfortunate that this is so. But somehow we ought to be able to convey to the public the impression that we're doing useful work toward their health. But they haven't seen the progress, I'm afraid. And so it worries me.
Yeah. So those are the risks and the opportunities for epidemiology and the state of...
Well, I don't think of risks to begin with, particularly, although I worry about young people who set out to do case control studies for the rest of time without any real sense of what to study and how to study. But as for looking into the future opportunities, I feel that there are an enormous amount of opportunities in the meta-epidemiologic realm in particular. That is, the development of the knowledge base of clinical affairs, knowledge base appropriate for expert systems, codification of diagnostic probability functions and others, and there's a way of getting that information from those experts, as I explain on that in that book on clinical epidemiology. So I would be thrilled to be a beginning researcher today and engage in these efforts. One can see productivity down the pike very securely.
Mm-hmm. Tied into the information age that we're in now?
Very much the beginning that practice ought to be driven by expert systems rather than by inspiration and subjectivity.
Now, do you have any predictions about what the future might hold for our field?
I have quite a strong sense of that, actually. Epidemiology has been in the service of public health and subservient to public health all along, and will continue to be in this role. But public health has profoundly changed in recent decades without public healthers always noticing, which is amazing. One of these enormous holes again. Public health used to be community health, community medicine and the paramedical activities in the community, public health, because that was the only public domain in healthcare. The community domain. Clinical medicine was business outside government.
You mean public in the funding side of it?
Any side. Being a bricklayer, being a surgeon, from the government point of view, they were in trades. And we have nothing much to do with those. Clinical medicine was extrinsic to government concerns in all essence.
Right.
Government was concerned with community health.
Right.
Medicine and non-medicine community health, community medicine included. But then came national health insurance. And now clinical medicine became an element in public health. Public health had an enormous expansion.
Publicly funded healthcare. Is that what you mean?
Indeed.
Yeah.
National health insurance is about public funding of medicine, meaning clinical medicine, which was not previously publicly funded. So now public health is principally by far about clinical medicine. A minister of health is preoccupied with clinical medicine.
That's right.
And preoccupied with one feature of clinical medicine overwhelmingly, namely cost.
Yeah.
And now, therefore, whereas politicians and economists have been trying to find solutions to this problem that is already bad and getting worse and will always continue to get worse and worse. Solutions are needed. Question: do epidemiologists have something to bring? They have not really brought anything of note yet, I am afraid. But I think they really have to get on with this topic, this new topic of public health. And there, what are the roles? The first role, I think, would be one of being the diagnosticians of the ills of healthcare, clinical healthcare overwhelmingly, meaning wasteful proceedings there. Diagnosing these, bringing these to the attention of the relevant decision makers, so as to liberate the system from waste. This is not science, but it is very important public health work in today's public health. But the other thing then is the one that I just mentioned, namely that epidemiologists should be there in the front line of making clinical practice expert system driven. It takes epidemiologists to work with clinicians to produce those systems and thus bring everybody really to professionalism in the practice of clinical medicine rather than this individual decision making and contemplation. You know very well from the epidemiology point of view that the lead idea in this direction has been that of Cochrane, Archie Cochrane, that if only practitioners knew what treatment works best, they would all use the best or most effective treatment, and the National Health Service of UK would now be more efficient if only doctors knew better. Mm-hmm. And so his solution was cultivation of randomized trials. I start from the same problem and I say if only doctors knew what the most illustrious colleagues think and do, they would do likewise. And again, waste would be avoided and costs would come down and quality would improve. So I am basically suggesting a role different from Cochrane, but a larger role, something whose results are more quickly and less expensively attainable.
Do you hold any promise for, do genomics hold any promise for the maintenance and promotion of health, or are they just a big fad?
There has been, as you know, a huge promotion of the idea that solutions to problems of health come from genetics and proteomics and so on. The mapping cost was $3 billion. And now the question is, so was it worthwhile? You know that the genetics work thus far has been very frustrating in two ways. First, that when you are looking for genetic determination of illnesses, the ability to find major genes has been very frustrating. Perhaps it's not the question of ability, but the existence. The existence. So that the idea then of genetics-based remedies, I think, is much less promising now than it used to be. Let me just quickly, apropos, if I may, say that I went to my class reunion, medical school class reunion, and a colleague of mine, a molecular biology expert for Europe, a German professor now, he said that in the 70s a book came out delineating what innovations basic science will bring to medicine in the next 20 years. And he says, we are now 20 years into the future, and I'll tell you about the realization of those promises. The long and short of it was very short. Nothing has materialized. And I have a certain fear that this genomics topic is not different. That when a quarter century now this question is raised, what has been the innovation in medicine from this source, I am afraid that it's not going to be very laudatory in respect to the prognostication.
Except to sell personal genome-wide scans for individuals that they won't know what to make of when they get the answer. There will be some of that.
I bought my first car in Minneapolis, the car dealer, for some reason, was prompted to say that there are two things over-advertised in America. The American Housewife and the Mayo Clinic. I don't know.
Where is he coming from? Yeah.
But as for today's over-advertising in the health business, I'm afraid that the genomics enterprise is in that category. Yeah,
yeah. Well, let's not be negative at the end. I want to hear the most important piece of advice you could give to a new epidemiologist starting a career. And I imagine you're positive about it.
I am very sanguine about the idea that somebody who is suitably programmed, so to speak, will have a very good, promising career in the sense of the societal yield for one and personal satisfaction of accomplishment for another. And as I study the history of ideas, as I indicated, I am very much a student of, there's nothing like the phenomenon of enlightenment, how it changed thinking and was the platform for progress in science and consequently in societies at large. So it's good to recall what the maxim really was of enlightenment as perpetuated by Immanuel Kant, the philosopher, for example. And it was, as you probably well know, sapere aude. Sapere aude was the maxim of enlightenment, meaning dare to reason or dare to think for yourself. So it's this business of being an independent agent rather than merely a perpetuator of the past, as was the idea before enlightenment. That would be the beginning. But then there's this other thing which perhaps is worth mentioning. I grew up, as you know, in cardiology in medical school, and subsequently even I had a long-term cardiology appointment, in fact, in Boston. But in any case, I was consulting with Paul Hugenholtz in Erasmus University early on in the 60s already. And on his wall would be this...
Who was he?
Paul Hugenholtz, cardiologist. Okay. He was in Children's Hospital at Harvard, and then he was recruited to Erasmus, the new medical faculty, as being the showcase department there. Okay, so on his wall, I can read, make no small plans. They have no magic in stirring men's blood. Make no small plans. They have no magic in stirring men's blood. So a certain ambitiousness has to be there for accomplishment in the arts, in sports, and so too, let's be clear, in science. If you don't have ambition and self-confidence in ability to achieve vision and results and achieve end results, then I don't think you really belong. So you have to have the daring to dream big dreams, and then the sort of creativity to get to the particulars and the tenacity to pursue the goals. But once you have the philosophical orientation, it seems to me that the future for a young, today's young epidemiologist is very good, whether looked at from the outside, the societal point of view, or from the inside, as for their career satisfaction.
On that very inspirational note, I want to thank you on behalf of the readers and viewers, I hope, of this interview. So thank you again, Dr. Vieta.
Thank you for all the insightful questions.
Thanks for listening to Voices, a project of the journal Epidemiology. We hope you enjoyed it. You may also be interested in a short video clip of this interview, which you can access through the journal's website. An edited version of this interview was published in the May 2012 issue of the journal.